The other morning, Kathy and I were caravanning out of Del Rio on our way to the Dallas-Fort Worth area to deliver a car to our youngest son. And I won't bore you with all the details, but about a month ago, a driver up in Denton could not stop coming up to Andy, who was sitting at a traffic light. It was raining. The driver behind him was going too fast, hit the brakes, and bam, turned Andy's beautiful car into salvage. And that set into motion a whole lot of things that I won't bore you with this morning. Until the other morning, we are caravanning out of Del Rio, and I'll never forget, I may forget someday, but I was coming down that hill. You know, when you take 277, we always go the back way. We never like to go in that 35 parking lot in Austin. Whew. At any rate, we're coming down a hill on 277 to that bridge that goes over the lake. And I hate that bridge because there are crosswinds there, and there are strong crosswinds, and the car always seems to do this. And then, you know, I almost always encounter a bus or an 18-wheeler coming the other way. You know what I'm talking about? And so I'm going down through, and I remember the thought came to me, you know, it's amazing that we're even taking this trip because so many things went wrong. So many things went wrong. It's just amazing that we're even taking this trip and delivering a car to Andy. So many things went wrong. I was on the verge of being a little like Jacob in our passage this morning when he said, "Everything is against me." You ever felt like that? You ever felt like it, no matter what you did, it was wrong? No matter what choice you made, it was the wrong choice. No matter what direction you took, it was the wrong. Everything is against me. I guess that's a little bit of what I was feeling when I said, it's amazing that we're even taking this trip. So many things went wrong. This morning we're getting into Genesis 42. And we're going to get some lessons from the life of Jacob again. The life of Jacob's sons, Joseph's brothers, and especially from the life of Joseph. We're going to learn three things, one from each of them, one from the brothers, one from Jacob, one from Joseph. But Genesis 42 advances the story. Some 20 plus years have passed since Joseph was sold into slavery. They are now through the 7 years of plenty in Egypt, and they are now in the midst of the 7 years of famine in Egypt. But not only Egypt is affected by the famine, so is the land of Canaan, where Jacob and Joseph's brothers reside. Now, it's been a long time since he's seen them, 20 plus years. It's been a long time since they'd seen him. I wonder if they put out of their minds what they had done to him. I wonder if they had somehow been able to just bury the memory of Joseph's cries, asking them to save him as they were carting him off into slavery. I wonder how long it took for those echoes to die down in their heads. I wonder how long or how often they might have, in those 20 plus years, awakened in the middle of the night to those sounds. We don't know. But in chapter 42, after 20 plus years, Joseph encounters his brothers again. Interestingly enough, he recognizes them. They don't recognize him. Let's look at Genesis chapter 42. When Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you just keep looking at each other?" I just got a kick out of that. When I was studying that passage, first of all, I thought that's an interesting thing. You know, there is Jacob, the father, and he's got these 10 sons, and he's saying, "You know what? We are running out of food, and all you can do is stand there and look at each other." And then the next thought that struck me is how different from Joseph. Remember, Joseph is a slave and in prison for some 13 years. And after 13 years, he's wrenched out of prison into the presence of Pharaoh. He interprets Pharaoh's dreams for him. And he immediately says to Pharaoh, by the way, this is what you ought to do. Take 20% of the food during the 7 good years, put it away, and then during the 7 lean years, you'll have that food to feed Egypt and the surrounding nations. He immediately knew what to do. What a difference between Joseph and the brothers. What have they been doing all these years? They're not in prison. They're not slaves. What have they been doing? So Jacob says to them, why do you just keep looking at each other? So he continued, I've heard that there's grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so that we may live and not die. Then 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin. Now in this passage, a couple of times, we get a little bit of hint, perhaps. We don't know for certain because the text doesn't tell us. We get a little bit of a hint, perhaps, that maybe he didn't really totally buy the story the other sons told him about Joseph's death. And he is not about to lose the other son of his favorite wife, Rachel. Remember, Joseph and Benjamin are full brothers from the wife that Jacob dearly loved, Rachel. So Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with the others because he was afraid that harm might come to him. You never know what might happen when you have a son in the presence of the other 10. So Israel's sons, that's Jacob's other name, the name God gave him, Israel's sons were among those who went to buy grain, for the famine was in the land of Canaan also. Now Joseph was the governor of the land, the one who sold grain to all its people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. Joseph was the guy you had to go see to buy grain from. And his brothers show up, and what do? They bow down with their faces to the ground. Now, what does that remind you of? The dream. When Joseph was 17 years old, he had a dream that his brothers would all bow down to him. He had another dream that not only his brothers, but his mother and father would bow down to him as well. I like what one writer said about these brothers. They were unaware that they fulfilled the dreams they had gone to such desperate lengths to defeat. They had gone to such desperate lengths of selling Joseph into slavery so that his dreams could not be fulfilled, that they would never bow down to him. And here they are, bowing down before him. Boy, when God works... And they were unaware, as the writer said, that they were fulfilling the dreams that they went to such desperate lengths to avoid. And I don't want to take time again. We're not going to take time. But God, you know, a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month or two ago, we did a message about God's providence. We see God's providence all over this passage. Well, as soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. Where do you come from? He asks. From the land of Canaan, they replied, to buy food. Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Then he remembered his dreams about them and said to them, you're spies! You have come to see where our land is unprotected. Do you sense the tension in this scene? You've got these 10 brothers. They're bowing low. They don't know who they're bowing to. After all, it's only right that they wouldn't recognize Joseph. A lot of years have gone by. 20 plus years have gone by since they sold him into slavery. Not only that, he looks very Egyptian now. He has Egyptian dress on. He's clean shaven the way the Egyptians were. An Egyptian headdress. He spoke Egyptian. He spoke to them through an interpreter, so they did not know that he understood their Hebrew tongue. You can understand why they wouldn't recognize him. They hadn't seen him for a long time, and he just looks like another Egyptian official. But Joseph immediately recognized them, and Joseph remembered his dreams. But there's a little problem here. His dream said all his brothers would bow down to him, but there's one missing, isn't there? Benjamin's not here. His dream said his mother and father would bow down to him, but Jacob's not here. And though his mother has died, it may be talking about Leah. So he remembers the dreams. Now he treats them harshly. Now, why is he harsh with them? Why is he harsh with them? I want to first tell you why I think he's I don't think he's being harsh. And he's not being harsh because he harbors ill will against them. He's not being harsh because he wants revenge upon them. He's not being harsh with them because he wants to inflict pain on them. He's not being harsh with them because he wants to be vindictive with them. How do we know that? Well, we know that because in this passage and in later passage in Genesis, there are many times when Joseph has to turn aside to weep. He's so overcome with emotion at seeing his brothers. But we also know it because of what we learned last week in Genesis 41. Remember, Joseph had two sons in the land of Egypt. Do you remember what he named the first son? If you don't remember, it's okay. It's okay for you to forget. That's what he named his son. That's what he named his firstborn son, Manasseh. You can see it back in chapter 41, verse 51. Joseph named his firstborn Manasseh and said, "It is because God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household." In other words, Joseph has already dealt with this in his life. He's already put aside the anger. He's already put aside the desire for revenge. He's already put aside the desire for vindictiveness. He's taken care of that in his life. So I don't think he's harsh with them out of a sense of trying to pay them back. Because we see his weeping and his tenderness, and not only in this passage, but in subsequent passages in the book of Genesis. I think he's harsh with them as a test. I think he needs to test them. Number one, he needs to understand, have they been confronted with what they did to him? Have they been convicted of their sin? Have they confessed their sin? See, a lot of times when we get separated from our sin by days or months or years, we forget about it and we kind of tuck it away and bury it in the back of our minds. But God remembers. And God is about to bring their sin to them full blown in this passage. Remember that happened with David. He had the dalliance with Bathsheba, adultery, and then he called back her husband Uriah, and when Uriah was more noble than David, David sent Uriah back to the battlefield and instructed that he be placed in the very front of the battle and they would withdraw from him and he'd be killed. That's how David took care of his problem, by piling sin upon sin. And then David went on with his life. But God wasn't about to let that stand, was he? Do you remember what God did? Who did he send to David to confront him with his sin? The prophet Nathan. And he sent him there, and Nathan told him a story that paralleled, a sort of a parable, if you will, that paralleled what David had done to Uriah and Bathsheba, and David's sin became clear to him. God convicted him of his sin. You see, we can hide sin, we can bury it, we can pretend it's not there, but God desires that we deal with it. And so I think this is a test. Joseph wants to see, have they changed? Are they different? Have they come to terms with what they did to him? Not out of revenge. There's another part of this as well. If there is to be complete and total forgiveness, there must be acknowledgement of their sin. One writer said this: to excuse people who are not sincerely repentant is to make them a worse sinner. It wasn't revenge, it wasn't vindictiveness, it was a test on the part of Joseph. "You're spies. You've come to see where our land is unprotected." "No, no, my lord," they answered. "Your servants have come to buy food. We're all the sons of one man. Your servants are honest men, not spies." "No," he said to them, "you have come to see," I'm reading verse 12, "where our land is unprotected." But they replied, "Your servants were 12 brothers, the sons of one man, who lives in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with our father, and one is no more. Wrong. He's right there in front of you. Why did they tell him all this history? Because the point is, if we were spies, if we were coming to spy out your land, certainly our father wouldn't send all of us minus one. But Joseph learns some important information throughout these interrogations. What he learns is that Benjamin is still alive. For all Joseph knew, maybe they decided to get rid of Benjamin as well. He also learns his father is still alive. The youngest is now with our father, and one is no more. So he learns a lot about the family. Joseph said to them, "It's just as I told you, you are spies, and this is how you will be tested. As surely as Pharaoh lives, you will not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of your number to get your brother. The rest of you will be kept in prison so that your words may be tested to see if you're telling the truth. If you're not, then as surely as Pharaoh lives, you're spies." And he put them all in custody for 3 days. Now, isn't it interesting? He puts them in custody for 3 days. They're carted away in chains to prison. Now, what does that remind you of? And what would that remind them of? What? When their brother Joseph was put into chains and carted away. You see, all of a sudden, they're made to feel like he felt. Without power, powerless to do anything about your situation, pleading with his brothers. That's what we're going to learn in a few verses. Pleading with his brothers, "Please spare my life." One writer said that all of this is to stir up the memory of what they had done to him, to bring conviction of sin, to stir up their consciences. Well, 18 tells us, "On the third day, Joseph said to them, 'Do this and you will live, for I fear God.'" If you are honest men, now by the way, you know, let me take a little aside here just for a moment. Okay, "for I fear God." Joseph lets them know he fears God. Now this is an interesting point. And one of the commentators made a good point about this. I'm going to throw this out for you to think about and study, okay? That's some of what we do here on Sunday morning. You know, I'm not going to put everything on the lower shelf. I'm going to put it up here so you can study and you can think, okay? And you can go through these passages. Think about what a difference is when you are in the hands of somebody who fears God and when you're in the hands of somebody who does not fear God. There's a big difference. When you are subject to somebody who fears God, you have hope. If you're in the hands of somebody who doesn't fear God, there isn't hope. I want you to think about that. Think about, you know, make some application of that. Come and tell me next week what you came up with, okay? Make some application of that. When a person or government is over you who fears God, you have nothing to fear. Think about the opposite. "Now Joseph was the governor of the land." We've already read let's read verse 18. "On the third day, Joseph said to them, 'Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you're honest men, let one of your brothers stay here in prison while the rest of you go and take grain back for your starving households. But you must bring your youngest brother to me so that your words may be verified and that you may not die.' This they proceeded to do." But all of this, all of their treatment by Joseph, all of what's going on, all of this leads them to be convicted about what they did to him. Again, I don't know, did they bury this in the back of their mind? Did they put Joseph out of their mind? Did they ever get together in little groups and say, "I wonder what's happened to Joseph"? We don't know, but we do know that now God, through Joseph, brings conviction to them. Verse 21, "They said to one another, 'Surely we are being punished because of our brother. We saw how distressed he was when he pleaded with us for his life, but we would not listen. That's why this distress has come upon us.'" It's interesting that God allows them to feel exactly what Joseph felt. God allows them to have the same emotions that Joseph had when he was dragged away into slavery. Reuben replied, "Didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy? But you wouldn't listen. Now we must give an accounting for his blood." They did not realize that Joseph could understand them since he was using an interpreter. He turned away from them and began to weep, but then turned back and spoke to them again. He had Simeon taken from them and bound before their eyes. What could be more reminiscent of what happened to Joseph as Simeon is separated from them, bound and taken away to prison? God brings conviction fully upon their hearts. One writer said they now feel the distress Joseph felt, the helplessness he felt, the anguish he felt. It was a necessary step to making things right. Another writer said this: Joseph's plans were not in revenge for how his brothers once treated him. Rather, they were to show how in God's world the guilt of the brothers came back on them and called for justice. See, God wasn't about to let it go. He gave Joseph the ability to forget the sting of those memories. Joseph was not imprisoned by the memories of what had happened to him. He was not imprisoned by bitterness. He was not imprisoned by the desire for revenge, as so many people are today when they are wrongly treated. He was free of that, but they had to be confronted with their sin. And that's what God is doing now through Joseph. There had to be an accounting. They had to admit their guilt, to acknowledge their guilt, to own their sin. For them is the first step toward making things right. Verse 24, he turned away from them and began to weep, but then turned back and spoke to them again. He had Simeon taken from them and bound before their eyes. Why Simeon? Why Simeon? The oldest was... Who remembers the oldest brother? Who's the firstborn in that family? Reuben. Reuben was the firstborn. But you remember Reuben had tried to keep them from harming Joseph. And so instead, Joseph chooses Simeon, the second born. And we don't know why, but that might be the reason that he allows Reuben to go. Verse 25, Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain, to put each man's silver back in his sack. That's his grace to them. And to give them provisions for the journey. After this was done for them, they loaded their grain on their donkeys and left. At the place where they stopped for the night, one of them opened his sack to get feed for his donkey, and he saw his silver in the mouth of the sack. "My silver has been returned," he said to his brothers. "Here it is in my sack." Their hearts sank, and they turned to each other trembling and said, "What is this that God has done to us?" See, they understand God's dealing with them. Their sin has come to the surface, and God is dealing with them. The word "trembling" there in the NIV is literally means shaking. When they realized the predicament they were in, and it's going to get worse in just a few verses, they were shaking, literally shaking. The same word is used in other places to speak of an earthquake. They were literally shaking. But to their credit, they realized that what's happening to them is at the hand of God, not Joseph. When they came to their father, Jacob, in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened. And they went through, they told him the man was harsh. We tried to say, he called us spies. We said we were honest men. Then they tell Jacob, this is how the man of the land said, "This is how I will know whether you're honest men. Leave one of your brothers with me. Take food for your starving households and go. But bring your youngest brother to me so that I will know that you're not spies but honest men. Then I'll give your brother back to you, and you can trade in the land." Now, just when you think things can't get worse, look at verse 35. As they were emptying their sack, there in each man's sack was his pouch of silver. You get the picture? They don't know that Joseph returned their silver. All of their money was at the top of their pouches. Their brother Simeon was in prison in Egypt. And the man in charge in Egypt, who they do not know, is Joseph, said, "Unless you bring back your youngest brother Benjamin, you'll never get any more food." And it is assumed what would happen to Simeon. That's why we read, "When they and their father saw the money pouches, they were frightened. Their father Jacob said to them, 'You have deprived me of my children. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more.'" He assumes Simeon's already dead. "Simeon is no more. And now you want to take Benjamin. Everything is against me." Have you ever said that? Don't raise your hand. Have you ever said that or felt that? "Everything is against me. Everything is against me. I'm trying to do it all right and everything is against me. It seems nothing is going right." Everything is against me. Was that a true statement? Don't be afraid. Come on, folks. Don't be afraid. Was that a true statement? Was everything against Jacob? No, because he didn't have enough information, did he? He didn't know that the person that treated his sons harshly was his son Joseph. Joseph's not dead. Simeon's not dead. God sent Joseph ahead into Egypt to prepare a way for the family to be preserved, for the nation of Israel to grow into mighty proportions. "Everything is against me." No, Jacob, you're looking at it through human eyes. You're not looking at it through eyes of faith. Everything is not against you. You just don't know it. And you're not even open to it. You're not even open to it that God might be doing something special in your life. Something that you could not even imagine. Everything's against me. I want you to remember, when you say everything's against me, you don't know it all. You don't know the end from the beginning. You don't know what God might do in your situation. But I can tell you this, if you're a believer in Jesus Christ, you do know that He's at work. Do know that He's at work. We'll have more to say about that in just a moment. Reuben said to his father, you may put both of my sons to death if I do not bring Benjamin back to you and trust him to my care. I'll bring him back." Jacob said, "My son will not go down there with you. His brother's dead. He's the only one left. If harm comes to him on the journey you are taking, you will bring my gray head down to the grave in sorrow." Jacob said, "I can't send Benjamin. It will kill me. Because everything's against me." All right, let's look at some. What can we learn from Jacob? What can we learn from Joseph's brothers? What can we learn from Joseph in this passage? Let's take them one at a time, real quickly, and we'll try to wrap things up and be done. All right? Lessons from Joseph. No bitterness, no revenge. Acknowledges through the name of his first son Manasseh that God had given him the ability to forget the stings of the past. The people who had offended him, the people who had mistreated him. God gave him the ability. You see, some of us need forgetfulness today. We need forgetfulness about those who have wronged us. But we want to keep extracting. We want to keep extracting revenge. We want to keep extracting something from them because they hurt us deeply. Boy, if anybody could have done that, Joseph could have done that, but he didn't do that. He allowed God to help him to forget. He didn't forget the things happened to him. They just no longer held him hostage. Are you being held hostage today by a memory? A memory of a person who harmed you or hurt you? Are you being held hostage today to that? Free yourself! Charles Swindoll said this, "It's time for a few penetrating questions which only you can answer. Are you the kind of person who keeps a little list? Do you remember what you would be better off forgetting? When someone has done you wrong, do you allow the Spirit of God to erase that offense? Or do you cling to a grudge, secretly adding their name to your list and wait for that choice opportunity to strike back? Those were the questions Joseph faced and answered correctly. How about lessons from the brothers? From the brothers, we can learn this. Be sure that your sin will find you out. I've talked before about the fact there is no such thing as hidden sin. Sin will find you out. If there is a sin in your life that you have buried, that you have tried to put away, that you have tried to forget till you get to the point where you say, well, maybe it didn't really happen. You know it happened. But you've never dealt with it. You've never named it. You've never brought it to God. You've never confessed it to God. God wouldn't allow that situation to go on with the brothers. Their sin found them out. They came under conviction. They confessed their sin. Confession, conviction, and confession of sin will lead to repentance. That is the change of mind, a change of action. I'd like to have more time to deal with this, but I just want to direct you to Psalm 32, verses 3 to 5. David said this about his sin with Bathsheba. When I kept silent, that is when I tried to hide my sin, when I tried to bury it, when I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My strength was sapped as in the heat of summer. Then I acknowledged my sin to you and did not cover up my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin. Psalm 32 and Psalm 51 are David's confessions to God when God brought conviction to his life. I'm going to let you read Psalm 51. The compact guide that I mentioned to you from time to time mentions some reasons that we should confess our sin to God. Many people sometimes say, well, why should I confess my sin to God? He knows my sin. He knows what I did. Why should I actually name it? Why should I confess it? Well, number one, the Word of God calls for you to do that, and for me to do that, to name our sin, to own our sin. But I'm quoting here from the Compact Guide. Why should we confess our sin to God? Doesn't He already know them? Hidden sin, as they say, festers and corrupts. It divides and destroys in your life. Hidden sin, a confession rather, releases God's forgiveness. You see, we already have the forgiveness of the cross, and obviously all of our sins, past, present, and future, are forgiven. But those sins that we go through life committing, that separate us from fellowship with God, not from a relationship with God. We can never lose our relationship with God. Once saved, always saved, and thank God for that. My salvation isn't dependent on my keeping myself saved. But you see, just as Jesus had to wash the feet of his disciples at the Last Supper, you see, when people came from the bath in that day, they walked through those dusty, dirty streets with all kinds of stuff I don't want to think about running through them. And so their feet got dirty. That's why they washed their feet. That's why it was a slave's job to wash their feet before a dinner. They were clean, but they needed their feet cleansed. You see, we're cleansed from sin, past, present, and future. But as we go through life, we commit sins, and they separate us not from God, but from fellowship with God. The joy of salvation, the joy of our relationship with Him. Confession releases forgiveness, as the Compact Guide says. Confession brings you into reality. It frees you, I'm quoting here, from the bondage of lies, self-deceit, and delusion that Satan wants to keep you in. Confession restores our relationship with God, that fellowship with Him, And lastly, they say, confession makes life more pleasant. Not confessing robs your joy, your peace, your comfort around God, and ultimately even your health. It's not worth it. Lastly, what can we learn? We've learned from Joseph that there may be somebody we need to forgive. We've learned from the brothers that we can't hide our sin. We need to confess it, repent. That just doesn't mean feel sorry for it. It means to turn around. It means it's an action word, not a feeling, emotion word. From Jacob, we learn this, that we need to look for God in our situation. We need to look for God in our situation. You see, Jacob said, everything is against me. Everything is against me. As one great older commentator said, everything was working together for his good and for the good of his family. But he didn't know that. Everything was working together for his good and for the good of his family. But he didn't know that. Why didn't he know that? Because he got into that place in life where all he could see was what was humanly happening to him. He left out thinking about what God could be doing in his life. And when you do that, folks, let me tell you what happens. You become negative and pessimistic and resigned to life. Everything is against me. No, it's not, Jacob. You don't know it, but everything is for you, for your good, for the good of your family. Let me ask you to write something down. Write this statement down. When you think things are as bad as they can get, when you think things are as bad as they can get, they are better than you know. When you think that things are as bad as they can get, they are better than you know. Look at them through the eyes of faith. I don't have time this morning, but I'm going to ask you to turn to Romans 8, verse 28 and the following verses. All things work together for good to those who love God, who are called according to His purpose. God is right now at work in your life, working everything for good. But you got to live by faith. You can't be a Jacob. You can't look at the situation from just strictly human eyes and say, everything is against me. When you leave God out of the equation, what you do is you become negative, pessimistic, resigned. As a child of God, always assume that everything is going to work ultimately for your good. One writer said this, the Scripture frequently indicate that God affects His program in ways man little understands or recognizes at the time. Joseph being sold into Egypt, the following distressing years of famine, the resulting visits by his brothers in search of food, all served to bring about the descent of Jacob's family to Egypt and the consequent sojourn there, where its number would increase to the size of a nation. It was no doubt difficult at the time to see the good in these restrictive developments, but God saw them working together to bring about His plan for Israel. You and I need to see through His eyes. I drove over that bridge on 277 and the thought came to my mind, as I said earlier, so many things went wrong. And then immediately the thought came to my mind, no, so many things went right. Let's bow together in prayer.